Good morning. Happy Wednesday. 6:05 here on a Wednesday.
Hump day.
It's hump day.
Guess what day it is?
Hump day.
And I think at this point we're getting over the severe weather. I think we're moving past it now.
I hope so.
At least for a few days.
We had two in a row.
Two in a row, lots of trees down, hail.
Oh, man.
Down trees all over the area, power lines, certainly. And even some closures in some areas, too.
Yeah, a couple of popular metro Detroit parks temporarily closed after the storms caused some widespread damage across the region. The Huron-Clinton Metro Park system says both Kensington Metro Park and Stony Creek Metro Park were impacted by extreme weather that moved through the area, prompting an immediate shutdown for safety. Crews are now assessing damage, clearing debris, evaluating conditions throughout both parks. Officials say the closure is expected to remain in place with a full reassessment plan for this morning. The Huron-Clinton Metro Park system says safety remains the top priority, and they're asking visitors for patience and understanding as cleanup efforts continue and conditions are reviewed. You can best believe they'll get it together before this weekend. It's a big weekend for a metro park.
It's Memorial Day weekend. Absolutely. Yeah,
so they'll have it together.
Yeah, they got to get it together. Yeah. But they will. They always do. They do such a wonderful job.
They do.
But, yeah, I think I've seen that they're going to get the weather gets a little nicer now.
Yeah, it does.
So at least for a couple days, we get a little bit of a reprieve from the storms that have just kind of rolled through.
The Detroit Police Department is considering a major shift in how it detects gunfire across the city as it weighs whether to replace its current ShotSpotter system with a new vendor. Police Chief Todd Bettison told City Council that the department is seeking bids from multiple companies and is requesting a 9-month, $2.06 million extension to the existing contract, which expires at the end of June. Now, officials say the goal is to review newer gunshot detection technologies now available, including competing systems such as Flock Safety, which also operates license plate reader tools. Bettison says the department isn't committed to any single vendor and views the technology as an investigative tool that has helped generate arrests, warrants, and gun recoveries. But some council members are questioning cost, privacy, and effectiveness, with the mayor and others previously opposing the renewal, a final decision expected as the review process continues.
So they're going to, look for other vendors to potentially replace ShotSpotter?
ShotSpotter.
So it's interesting because there's this, it's a license plate reader technology called Flock.
Mm-hmm.
And they have this down in Austin, Texas. Well, in Austin, there's been shootings the last couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of teenagers driving around shooting people.
Yeah.
Well, there is the concern about Flock, which is, it might target or it might, put a spotlight on minorities. Those that are committing crimes. Or it might be ripe for just misuse, where you've got the police chief who's got a vendetta against somebody and now who can track this person around.
Exactly.
Well, they turned their Flock system off.
Because it was a lot of...
Because there was backlash against it. Okay,
yeah.
And look, no system's perfect.
No.
I think that we can all agree to that. We've talked about the license plate reader technology here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, unfortunately, the police had no idea who the shooters were. They couldn't catch them. They had no idea. It wasn't until they drove into a nearby community and the other city had their Flock system up, that's when they caught the shooters.
Uh-huh.
So, again,
maybe
nothing's perfect. Of course not.
Maybe a little reevaluation, maybe?
I think that's exactly what they're doing now.
Okay.
Reconsidering. Meanwhile, there were a number of primaries yesterday all across the country. I do want to focus particularly on one, and that is in Kentucky. Because that's where Thomas Massie is.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas Massie will have 7 more months as a Republican congressman from Kentucky because he lost his primary.
Yeah. To the Trump-backed candidate.
It was, and look, Ed Gallerine is somebody who he's got the credentials.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But Donald Trump's support threw him over the edge. And the really constant dismantling of Thomas Massie was something to see.
Oh,
because there was a full court press against Thomas Massie. Here was Ed Gallerine when he was talking to his supporters.
It was a David versus Goliath. I was the underdog. I want to thank the president. I want to thank the conservative Republicans from this district and my supporters and team, because it sends a message that we, the people, are going to stand up.
Meanwhile, Thomas Massie talking about his concession call.
I would have come out sooner, but I had to call my opponent and concede, and it took a while to find Ed Gowrine in Tel Aviv.
But the shots being fired there.
I'm telling you, man.
Here's the problem that Republicans may find themselves in. I mean, Thomas Massie won his seat the last go-around by a huge margin.
Oh, yeah.
Huge margin. Well, now he gets bounced in the primary. What type of candidate, you may win the primary, but are you a legitimate candidate when you get to an actual head-to-head election? And that's something that I don't know that we've gotten to yet,
mm-hmm.
because a lot of these primaries are running through, but it is just something to watch. Because, again, you look out in West Michigan with Peter Meyer.
Yeah.
And I just don't believe that that was the best candidate to trot out there for the Republicans.
Okay.
Even though the support was there from Donald Trump, all the money was there, and at the end of the day, wasn't the right candidate. I do wonder if we're going to see that in some of these races, including the Thomas Massie.
Well, I'm wondering, you know, for the candidates that were backed by Trump in the primary, you know, will he still have that same strength to carry them over in a general?
I don't know.
I mean, his numbers are down. Of course, the president's numbers are way down. And he still got wins last night.
Yes.
You know, so he still has some.
Well, he got wins in a primary.
Yeah.
Which is easier to do.
Sure.
I mean, it's easier to do. It's easier to do than when you're going up against the opposite party.
Yes.
Right? You're all talking to the same folks.
Yeah. Exactly.
At that point.
Exactly.
Right? You're trying to just parse things up.
Right.
But I do think the strength of candidate is going to matter in these races. They are going to matter. And you're right. Some of the external stuff that has nothing to do with the race in
mm-hmm.
particular,
mm-hmm.
Affordability, gas prices, all of those things, war.
Yes.
The economy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Just approvability of the president. All of those things are going to play. And if you're already maybe not having as strong of a candidate as an incumbent, that might be.
That might flip on you.
Might be some problems.
Yeah. There was a story yesterday, Chris, and I'm like, okay, how does this happen? Sterling Heights police investigating after a handgun was reportedly found inside a preschool student's backpack at Schwartz Kopf Elementary School. Authorities say that the staff in the Head Start program made the discovery about 8:15 yesterday morning, immediately secured the weapon before police arrived on the scene. Sterling Heights Police Youth Bureau was called in and is now working with the Utica Community Schools administrators to determine how the child obtained the firearm. Investigators say the case will be reviewed for possible criminal charges and forwarded to the Macomb County Prosecutor's Office. Police stress there is no ongoing threat to students and staff at the school as the investigation continues. They have found out that this gun is licensed to a parent of the child. They don't think the child had any ill intent, that the child may not have even known that the gun was in the backpack.
Okay.
So, I mean, what, as a parent,
what are we
you
doing?
Just,
irresponsible.
Put the gun in the backpack, you know? Oh,
yeah.
I forgot to take it out. I put it in there at night, but I don't know. But that's what it sounds like. And it's just, come on.
That is absolutely crazy to me. I don't know how that happens.
But kudos to the staff who noticed that, hey, this bag seems a little heavier
for
a little preschooler, you know? So kudos for them for checking that out.
Coming up on the other side, we've talked a lot about the teen takeovers. Is it a real problem or is it being overblown? We'll talk about it on the other side. It's Jer Morning. So in Tampa, 22 people were arrested, ages 12 to 21. In Orlando, 9 people arrested. In Chicago, 8 arrested. In Vegas, 70 arrested during these teen takeovers. Here in Detroit, over 100 have been detained. There were a couple of arrests in that shooting of a 14-year-old,
mm-hmm.
a 16-year-old, and a 17-year-old were taken into custody. There's been a number of parental responsibility citations that have been issued all during these teen takeovers.
Yes.
And the question is why are they happening, A? And B, are they really serious? Is this something that we should be concerned about? I know that me, who I don't live in the city. Mm-hmm. I come to the city.
Yeah.
I work in the city. Mm-hmm. It is problematic when you think of all the businesses that are down here.
Absolutely.
All the businesses that are being impacted, all the big shows and games that we've got downtown and people coming in from all over the metro area. It is a problem for them.
And people coming from other states when we have big events downtown. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't want to come here and feel like they're in some type of danger from, you know, from young people.
Krista Nicole Henning is the Bloom Professor of Law and the director of the Juvenile Justice Clinic Initiative at George Washington, is it?
It's in Georgetown.
Georgetown. I'm so sorry. At Georgetown.
That's okay.
Thank you for joining us this morning. We really appreciate it. Let's talk a little bit about this, because this is something that you've been watching pretty significantly. Why are these popping up all over the place?
Well, I think social media makes it easier, you know, and faster to gather young people together, in public spaces. But, I mean, when we think about it, it is no different than what we have seen, you know, over the years with young people gathering, whether it's, you know, after or before a football game, or, you know, there were skateboard parks. I mean, we can think, you know, bonfires, you know, beach over spring break, the series of these that we have seen over time. And so I think in many ways, it's no different. I think the questions that we, you know, need to ask are, you know, what are the kids in need of? Why are they gathering? You know, are there other alternative safe spaces for them to go and be and feel welcome and socialize, which is exactly what we want young people to do.
And you know, Kristen, the mayor here in Detroit, Mary Sheffield, you know, she's really big on youth. She's really invested in youth. And she invited some of the people, some of the kids who started the takeovers to her office. Now they're part, some are part of the administration. They have a whole youth section. They do these things called kickbacks where they're, you know, downtown on the waterfront and they have DJs and, you know, they have food trucks and they're down there and they're dancing and having a good time. But those are the kids who want to really actually come downtown and have a good time. You got the other ones who want to come down and have trouble. They're not going to be at the meeting. They're not coming down to the kickback. They want to start trouble. How do you deal with those?
Yes. And let me just quickly just say shout out to the mayor for doing that. I've read her interviews and seen her interviews, and really hats off. Here's the thing, though, with the very few young people who are engaged in delinquent behavior, we need effective, what we call public health interventions. You know, and what does that look like? That means making sure we are providing a continuum of mental health support for those young people, that we are working diligently to figure out and understand the root causes of their crime. So, for example, many of those young people have experienced trauma themselves, either in their family, in their community, in some way. Are we addressing that? Without stigmatizing those young people? Are we providing vocational opportunities, mentoring opportunities? Are they getting adequate one-on-one tutorial educational support in the right settings, those kinds of things? And what we find is that it's not that the teen takeover itself, the large gathering itself, that it's the problem. It's that we as a community need to work and serve those young people who are hurting the most and who need the most from the community. Because those folks are going to engage in delinquent behavior, whether they're in that teen takeover, as it's called, or whether they're, you know, in their own communities.
So you don't believe that policing necessarily should play a role here, that arrests should be made, things like that. There needs to be more opportunities for them to seek, you know, some sort of assistance if they need it.
I do lean heavily in the direction, because the research is clear that the more effective interventions are the public health interventions. But let me just say, with regard to policing, you know, the punitive interventions, the arrests. So, for example, when I hear you talk about 70 arrests in some locations, 100 kids being detained, we have to ask ourselves, to what end and for what purpose? And were those young people actively engaged in serious harm to businesses and to other people?
If a crime is committed, yeah. Right? If a crime is committed, then
exactly.
That action would need to be taken.
But I want to say to you, the serious crime that's a significant harm to other people. And so, and that might include vandalism to a particular building, but a lot of what we see is young people out after curfew is considered a crime, right? Or disorderly conduct for being loud is considered a crime. So I just wanted to level set a little bit with response to that. But yes, the young people who are engaged in the most serious, the shooting that hurt someone else, yes, we need police intervention for that. But the routine intervention of young people is actually more harmful than helpful. It increases trauma, which leads to further arrest and resentment of police officers. So the alternatives are really important in those low-level, you know, nonviolent offenses. It's really important to have alternatives to policing.
Professor Kristen Nicole Henning at Georgetown, thank you so much for your time this morning. We appreciate you.
Absolutely. Thank you both.
Yeah, you got it.
You're welcome.
You got it. I disagree with that.
I do as well. I mean, listen, you got people who are arrested for curfew, but we have a curfew. You get taken in. Now, she says, okay, well, a lot of these kids are acting up, have some problems at home and maybe some mental issues and those kind of things. They need places to go. Well, the mayor is providing places for you to go. I'm sure the police are talking to them when they have them in custody and saying, hey, this is what we have available. But if you don't want to take part of it, what do you do?
Great point. I think that's exactly right. Now, again, whether or not you think money should be allocated towards something like that as a City of Detroit resident or somebody who's invested in this is a completely different story, and we could have that conversation.
Yeah.
But if those opportunities are there for you and you're choosing not to participate,
and
then you go out and are doing things you shouldn't be doing,
right.
Well, then all of a sudden all bets are off.
I agree.
Then if you are breaking the law, if you are doing, I don't think vocational training is going to help in that situation, at least not in that moment.
There has to be some, you know, law enforcement intervention in there for when you break the law.
Again, it's very simple. We talk about lawlessness. You've heard lawlessness a lot.
Yeah.
And this is to a much minor degree. Okay, this isn't people going out, looting, robbing, all the more serious stuff,
yeah.
Right? Carjackings, things like
exactly.
that. We haven't seen that, at least. But there needs to be some sort of accountability.
Well, and you don't want it to escalate to that.
Yes.
We got to a shooting.
Certainly.
You know?
AIPAC at the center of a lot of these races in Michigan. We'll talk about it next. Well, the Democratic primary for this U.S. Open Senate seat being vacated by Gary Peters is being defined over AIPAC. AIPAC has become a hot-button talking point in this race. Haley Stevens, Mallory McMorrow, Abdul Al-Sayed. It feels like this race is a microcosm of the Democratic Party.
Mm.
They don't know if they should stick with more of the more moderate, more kind of establishment Democrat in Haley Stevens.
Uh-huh.
Or you go maybe more liberal, slightly over towards Mallory McMorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Or you go to the far progressive end with Abdul Al-Sayed.
Right.
And lots of money, lots of influence, lots of social media buzzing on certain issues. And so that flashpoint has created, in my mind, a real microcosm. But this issue on AIPAC was written about. Todd Spangler wrote an interesting piece in the Free Press about it, how AIPAC has become a dirty word in this race. Dave Duleo is a distinguished professor of political science and the director of the Center for Civic Engagement at Oakland University and rejoins us once again this morning. David, it's good to have you back.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for having me back.
Well, let's talk about this. How is AIPAC influencing this race?
Well, AIPAC is really just shorthand for the divide that you very deftly pointed out that exists in today's Democratic Party, right? I mean, it's really it's this flashpoint of contrast between the as you say, the establishment side of the party, the establishment wing of the party in somebody like Haley Stevens, and then the more progressive wing of the party with folks like Mallory McMorrow and Abdul Al-Sayed. It is the latest example of the division and factionalism that is really dominating Democratic politics at the moment.
You know, and with Gary Peters stepping aside, how much does this open seat amplify the tensions within the party?
Oh, gosh, Lloyd, it just makes everything turned up to 11 on the speaker volume. It's a seat that Democrats desperately want to maintain, right? In a year like 2026, where Democrats are likely to have a very good year electorally, if they lose this Michigan seat to Mike Rogers, it it severely dampens their chances of taking control of the United States Senate. And it just would be, in many ways, it would be an embarrassment to give up this seat that they've held for so long.
What is AIPAC? How much influence do they have over politics? We've heard a lot about them in the last couple of years, ever since Israel and Gaza, or excuse me, Israel and Hamas started their war. We've heard a lot about it in the cases that we're seeing now in Iran. What are they, and how much influence do they really have here over our U.S. politics?
Yeah, the amount of influence that AIPAC has is debated and argued about, and is controversial, actually, right? But AIPAC stands for the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, and it has a long and storied history in Washington. It was founded in 1943. So it's been around for, you know, a little over 80 years. And, you know, it has had this very influential presence lobbying in the nation's capital. It only started to get involved in elections just a couple of cycles ago. Really, it was started raising money to give to candidates through a political action committee in 2021. So it's been around for a while, but its electoral activity is really ramped up in the last couple cycles.
Professor, you know, there's also that issue of outside money and these so-called pop-up PACs. How much does that kind of muddy the water for voters who are just trying to understand who's backing who?
It muddies the water a great deal, Lloyd. It is, you know, sometimes groups are called quote-unquote dark money groups because we don't know where the funding originated or who gave it originally. But, you know, money is always been around in American politics. And because of this pesky little thing that we have here in the United States called the First Amendment and the Supreme Court's interpretation of the First Amendment, money is always going to be a part of our campaigns and a part of our politics. And AIPAC has been able to you know, really muster a lot of it and raise a lot of it so that they can be even more influential in these high profile races.
Really interesting. Dave Duley, always appreciate the time, the insight, something to continue to watch. That's for certain. We appreciate you. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, you got it. Meanwhile, finance ministers of the G7, mm-hmm. the G7 comprised of Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the UK, and of course the United States. They met in Paris to talk about this growing economic fallout from the Iran war, particularly as it has to do with oil prices that has ravaged global markets. And this idea that the conflict is driving up energy prices, it's disrupting supply chains, it is creating a sense of instability in the financial markets, and I suppose not even a sense. It has created instability in the financial markets, particularly with the Strait of Hormuz. So they're saying, look, we have to reopen the Strait. The Strait must be reopened. Well, Iran, meanwhile, has created a committee to oversee the travel of this commerce through the Strait. Again, mm-hmm. They don't. This is an international body of water. They've got a certain amount off the shore.
Sure.
Right? Yep. That belongs to Iran.
Right.
But more broadly, the Strait is an international waterway. Mm-hmm. So you've got the regime taking this step and trying to create an overarching body to oversee the travel through the Strait.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, they don't have the ability to do that, nor should they have the ability to do that. And the G7 finance ministers are saying, look, there obviously is a fragmentation that we're seeing here.
Definitely.
And the Strait of Hormuz should be open. There needs to be continued pressure on Russia and the sanctions that have put that have been put in place there. Mm-hmm. And the, of course, now the Chinese are heavily invested because they're seeing a dip in their oil imports. So it became a major talking point for the finance ministers yesterday in Paris.
And you know, those finance ministers, I mean, you know, the chiefs of these large, you know, advanced economies, they don't usually weigh in on shipping routes unless there's some serious risk to global markets, and they see that. And then you got Vladimir, who visited Xi Jinping, you know, Xi last week or a couple of days ago. What's that all about? You know, right after the president leaves, you know, then Putin comes in and has a little confab.
I'll tell you what, let's talk about that next. Jonathan Savage joins us. It's JR Morning. Hey, I thought we were special.
I thought we were too. The rollout, man, when the president was there over in Beijing, and I mean the nice rollout he had, and
I thought we were special.
Oh,
with
well.
All the kids out there with the American flags and the Chinese flags waving around. And then we see those same kids out there with Russian flags and Chinese flags waving them around.
Oh, well, playing both sides.
Well, and this confab between Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping obviously comes on the heels of Donald Trump's visit. What does it mean? What does it signal? What is it? What kind of pedestal does that put China on? Jonathan Savage is the Fox News reporter and, of course, WJR contributor, and joins us once again. Jonathan, good morning. It's good to have you. Boy, it felt eerily similar to what we saw the reception at the very minimum when Donald Trump visited Beijing.
I know, in these days of AI, part of you wonders, has Vladimir Putin just been inserted into the picture and played Donald Trump? But no, that I can assure you is what happened. Very, very similar. Like you're saying, the kids waving the flags, the goose stepping soldiers, all that kind of stuff. There's always a bit less formality when President Xi and Putin meet. They are more aligned than President Xi and President Trump. But it's definite that the Chinese, so soon after welcoming the American leader, didn't want to show the Russian leader any less respect.
Jonathan, you've got stalled peace talks and drone strikes hitting Moscow. How much urgency is Vladimir Putin bringing into these meetings? I mean, is he looking for some concrete support from China, or is it just some reassurance that he's not isolated?
Well, China really matters to Russia. The economic reality is stark for Vladimir Putin. China is now a major buyer of Russian oil and gas, a crucial source of technology and components for industry. And all that helps Russia withstand pressure from the West, the sanctions, the lack of openness to markets, all this kind of stuff. Without the Chinese money coming into Russia, financing and technology access, Russia's wartime economy, which is already not in great shape, would be in really, really bad strain. But China gets a benefit out of all this, too. They get cheap Russian energy. They get a strategic leverage, if you like, over Russia. And they get this partner who can join them ideologically in challenging the influence of the United States and Europe.
One of the things that Xi said was the international situation is marked by intertwined turbulence and transformation, while unilateral hegemonic currents are running rampant. What international situation, what international turbulence is he talking about? Because either the United States or Russia could be implicated in a statement like that.
Yeah, but I don't think he was talking about Russia, especially given that he parrots, I suppose. He goes along with the Kremlin's line that in terms of ending the war in Ukraine, the root causes have to be sorted. That's a term Russia uses. So in this joint statement, they talked about supporting a multipolar world, in other words, not just American influence in the world, and they condemned what they called military intervention, regime change, political destabilization, and actions violating sovereignty. A bit rich, you might say, for Russia to be condemning all these things. But I think the language is meant to reference American actions in Iran and also in Venezuela. Venezuela, of course, used to be a very big ally of Russia.
Also, you know, Xi is deepening his ties with Russia, excuse me, and he's talking about this partnership with the United States. Can China realistically have it both ways, Jonathan?
Well, they're certainly trying it, aren't they? They're trying to have it both ways. And a really interesting thing I thought, right, about all this was last week we heard about China buying about 200 Boeing aircraft. But China didn't confirm this until Vladimir Putin was in Russia. So they were confirming this previously announced deal to buy American aircraft while Vladimir Putin was in the country, almost like they were saying, look, here we are, big friends with Russia, but America, you're still important to us, too. Yeah. We still want trade relations with you as well.
The other thing, too, is when you're hosting back to back the president of the United States of America and then you host Vladimir Putin in, you know, just a few days apart, what does that signal in China's standing in the world at this point?
I think that if you are Xi Jinping, if you're in Beijing, you are standing there and you're getting all the most important leaders in the world coming to you looking to do deals. I think that what China is hoping the world sees is that China is preeminent right now. China is the country which is not tied up in conflicts and is able to focus on trade and the economy and stabilizing relations. So I think that's what China gets out of it. They get this appearance that the world is coming to them.
I mean, could China be positioning itself, Jonathan, and kind of as a go-between or even a broker in future negotiations involving Russia and the United States?
Very possibly. And later this year, it's thought that Xi Jinping will come to Washington September 24th, I think was the date that President Trump invited him on. And meanwhile, the Russians are not ruling out a potential meeting between Presidents Trump and Putin. So, you know, I think that while there's obviously trickiness in relations between all these three countries,
yeah,
the fact that China is the one talking to both most frequently kind of puts them in this position of being able to unite the world as they might want to be seen.
Interesting. Jonathan Savage, always great insight. Thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it. We'll talk soon.
Thank you. Take care.
Yeah, you got it. You do the same. Meanwhile, this is a fascinating story. A study that was presented this week, yesterday, as a matter of fact, to the American Psychiatric Association's annual meeting shows that there is a potential breakthrough in suicide treatment.
Yes.
Using a two-drug combination. It includes a single dose of ketamine, which is known for reducing suicidal tendencies, along with another drug that will help make those benefits last longer. Ketamine generally wears off pretty quickly. We've heard a lot about ketamine recently, but this new approach appears to extend the relief that you would get from these suicidal thoughts. Over the span of many weeks. And it's a basically a single dose treatment that you would find some relief over the span of many, many days.
And you're talking about a lifesaver. That could be
50,000 people die a year in the United States,
yes,
from suicide.
Yes.
7 o'clock hour coming up. Lots to talk about, including the situation in Cuba. It's next on JR Morning. Boy, I just looked up at our stream. You can stream us on Facebook, on YouTube, that whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Having a terrible hair day.
You think you're having a terrible
just
hair day?
Just a terrible hair day. Nothing is working. I don't know. So if you'd like to see that, you can head on over to our stream. Check that out.
Maybe you might.
Lloyd looks great as always.
Well, you know, I don't have much hair, and mine just kind of just sits there.
I love it. I'm jealous.
I'm just trying my hardest.
That's it.
Also trying his hardest, or at least will be this offseason, is going to be Trajan Langdon.
Yeah.
And one of the things that he said yesterday that I thought was pretty interesting was that I don't know that he even, I know he didn't, expect that they would be a contender at this point, that they would be in the position of having a 60-win team, going into the playoffs as the number one seed, and being the hunted as opposed to the hunter.
Yeah, a couple of years ago, they only won 14 games.
Correct. And so he said yesterday, we didn't think it'd come this fast. 2 years ago, nobody in here thought that I'd be getting championship contender questions, but here we are.
Yeah.
One of the things that he was asked yesterday, and I'm sorry, I don't remember who asked it, was, do you regret not making a bigger deal at the deadline? You know, they went out and got Herter from Chicago in that deal.
Mm-hmm.
That sent Jaden Ivey to Chicago, who later was released, by the way.
Yeah.
But regardless, Herter was injured throughout much of his time here. He was banged up. He didn't get to play a ton, but they thought maybe he would be that key piece, that shooter, particularly from the outside, that was going to make the difference.
Mm-hmm.
Best ability is availability, and he wasn't available nearly as much as they would have liked.
Yeah.
But he said, look, there was no stone that was not overturned. They did their due diligence. Sometimes the price was too high, and they didn't want to go that route. I think maybe because whether or not they expected to be here at this point, they were in the mix.
They were.
So,
definitely.
So the fact that that didn't transpire, he says that it wasn't for a lack of trying. He also talked about Jalen Duren.
Because everybody wants to know what that future looks like.
And he talked about it.
JD had a fantastic season, all-star, one of the biggest contributors to us being the number one seed. Darn near 20 points and 10 rebounds per game. An incredible year, an incredible leap from last year to this year because of the work that he put in last summer and his focus. And I have no doubt that we'll help him put a plan together and he'll attack it this summer just like he did last summer. He'll come back a better player from his experience not only during the regular season but also in the postseason just like all of our guys will. So we look forward to coming together with his representation, getting a deal done, and for him continue to be a Piston.
Okay.
That's pretty clear to me.
Looks like he's going to be coming back.
And I don't necessarily think that they're looking to unload Jalen Duren.
No. No.
But his postseason performance was disappointing, but he did make leaps and bounds of a difference for this team. And he's right. He was a huge piece to them winning 68.
Well, and also they want to keep Tobias around, too, and they're looking to try to, do that. Now, Trajan says, now, once we do this, it might not leave us much money to do something else if we need to do something else. But they're going to look and see and try to do what's best for the team.
Have to prioritize some things.
Yeah.
Yeah, certainly.
Sterling Heights police investigating a handgun that was reportedly found inside a preschool student's backpack at Schwarzkopf Elementary School.
What?
Yeah. And this was a preschooler who had a gun in their backpack. Authorities say the staff at this Head Start program, it's Head Start here.
Great.
Made the discovery yesterday morning, immediately secured the weapon before police arrived on the scene. The Sterling Heights Police Youth Bureau called in, now working with the Utica Community Schools administrators to determine how the child obtained the firearm. It's believed that the firearm is registered to the child's parent and that the child had no ill intent and more than likely didn't know that the gun was in the backpack. But kudos to the administrators at the school who noticed that this backpack.
Why does this preschooler have such a
heavy backpack? Yeah, so they checked it out and found this gun. So we'll see what happened. I'm sure, the prosecutor's office, Macomb County Prosecutor's Office, will be taking a look at this, and there'll probably be some charges forthcoming.
Mm. Well, thank God that didn't turn into something.
It could have been
really,
a lot
really
worse.
Bad.
Yeah.
Really, really bad. Donald Trump is the kingmaker. At least in primaries.
It appears so.
He certainly is flexing his muscles, and we saw that last night, particularly when it came to the Thomas Massie race. Massie was upset in his primary against Ed Gallrein, who is, a former Navy SEAL, somebody who kind of fits the mold of kind of the Donald Trump Republican.
Yeah.
And Thomas Massie talked to his supporters yesterday about the concession call that he needed to make.
I would have come out sooner, but I had to call my opponent and concede, and it took a while to find Ed Gallrein in Tel Aviv.
Boy, they still throwing blows.
We talked about AIPAC earlier. That's certainly a piece of it. And this comes as Senator Bill Cassidy in Louisiana was beat as well.
Mm-hmm.
So in some of these really big consequential races. Oh, and by the way, Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger.
Yeah.
Remember the whole call
and
after the 2020 election?
Yeah.
He did not advance to the runoff for Georgia governor. Well, yeah.
Because he was so much, against.
Without having to relitigate all of that.
Sure.
If Donald Trump puts his finger on the scale in primaries, not in a head-to-head, not in a general.
It's a little different in the general.
It is different. It is different because a lot more factors come into play.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to the primaries, Donald Trump certainly has a lot of sway. A lot of sway.
And just before we go, Detroit City Council member Mary Waters, she's been removed from the ballot in the Democratic primary for Michigan's 13th Congressional District. That's according to the Secretary of State's office. Waters was listed as disqualified Tuesday in the August 4th race against incumbent U.S. Representative Sri Tanadar, State Representative Donovan McKinney, and candidate John Gochi. Waters says she was informed the issue involves a number of voter signatures on her nominating petitions, and she is now appealing the decision through the State Bureau of Elections, where the matter remains under review.
7:12, time for WJR's Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rack your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial tech and startup community on WJR.
Good morning. Ann Arbor Spark, the nonprofit economic development organization focused on advancing the Ann Arbor region as a leading destination for innovation, business growth, and talent, has just hosted their annual meeting to celebrate the people, companies, and partnerships helping shape the future of economic opportunity across Washtenaw County and the greater Ann Arbor region. Nearly 400 business, government, academic, and community leaders attended the event held yesterday at Eastern Michigan University Student Center, and the event featured Ann Arbor Spark's 2025 successes across entrepreneurship, business growth, talent development, and regional investment, while also honoring the individuals and organizations whose leadership and contributions have helped strengthen the region's economy and entrepreneurial ecosystem. Paul Krutko, president and CEO of Ann Arbor Spark, had this to say about their big day. The event is an opportunity to reflect on the partnerships, innovation, and leadership that continue to move our region forward, he said. This year's honorees represent the very best of what makes the Ann Arbor region unique. Visionary leadership, entrepreneurial success, industry innovation, and a deep commitment to building opportunity for others. And here are some of the award winners recognized at the event. Volunteer of the Year, it's Michael Cole, recognized for decades of leadership and service to the region's entrepreneurial ecosystem as president of the Technology Industry Group at Bank of Ann Arbor. Entrepreneurial Services Company of the Year, that's Academ Life Sciences. They're recognized for continued growth as a leading life sciences company, developing innovative cell separation technologies used by researchers now around the world. Business Development Project of the Year, it's Torque Robotics. They received the award for their continued investment and expansion in the Ann Arbor region. The Economic Impact Award goes to American Center for Mobility, recognized for their transformational impact on the region's mobility economy as it celebrates its 10th anniversary. And the Legendary Award goes to Dr. Stephen Forrest. He received the Legend Award for his long-standing contributions to innovation, research commercialization, and economic development in the region. Congratulations to those award winners, and congratulations to Ann Arbor Spark on the great day they celebrated yesterday and all of their incredibly important contributions to our entrepreneurial and technology ecosystem here in Michigan's Southeast region. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com. And that's today's Business Beat on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
You know, in one of his return trips to Capitol Hill, Secretary of State Marco Rubio testified on the Cuba crisis.
Yeah.
And what's happening there. And he was asked if there would be regime change in Cuba. And he said, well, we're not going to force the issue of regime change, but we do want a regime change in Cuba, much like what we saw in Venezuela, much like what we're seeing in Iran. While they may not be openly calling for a regime change,
yeah,
that is part of the underlying issue here.
Yeah.
Is you've got these folks that are adversarial to the United States. They don't like us. And so that's something that they want to change.
And the DOJ is going after Raul Castro. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Cuba finds themselves in a situation because of what is happening around the world. They're out of oil.
Yeah.
And that is part of the impetus on now what the United States is seeing as an opportunity to potentially apply pressure to Cuba. There could be military action at this point as well. And the daily life for people in Cuba at this point is a tough one. But Cuba warning now that U.S. military action would cause a bloodbath at this point. The president there said Cuba does not represent a threat, but they will defend themselves if the United States takes action against the island nation. Let's talk about it. Professor Silvia Pedrez is the international sociology professor at the University of Michigan and joins us this morning. Professor, it's great to have you.
Thank you. It's, the last name is Pedraza.
Pedraza, excuse me. Appreciate that.
Right. Oh, that's fine.
Let's talk about the situation now. First of all, what state is Cuba in with the significant oil shortage at this point?
Well, my understanding is that at this point, you know, there has been a remarkable crisis because of the lack of gasoline, petroleum. And then Russia sent a vessel with a lot of gasoline, but that has also finished. So, in fact, they have nothing right now. That's my understanding.
And we're talking about, I understand, Professor, blackouts there lasting up to 20 hours a day. I mean, what happens to families and schools and hospitals and communities when electricity becomes that unreliable? And unavailable.
Yeah, no, and also the loss of electricity also means that, you know, people in Cuba have very difficult access to food. And when they finally find some, they put it in a freezer. And, you know, the food in the freezer spoils when there is no electricity. So it's not just about lack of electricity. It's also about lack of food. Lack of transportation.
Sure,
Last time I was in Cuba Christmas before this extremely severe crisis of electricity, but already there were, you know, huge manifestations of what was going to happen, and you can't get around. You know, there are no taxis. It's just impossible to find reliable ground transportation.
I was reading a story in The Hill, and one of the things that I found to be pretty interesting is Cuba has amassed about 300 military drones. They say they would use them if the United States took military action against them. There was one U.S. official that spoke on a condition of anonymity that said that this buildup of these military drones is a growing threat. How do these things materialize between the relationship between the United States and Cuba at this point?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the Cuban heads of the military said recently, we always knew that they would come, meaning the United States, you know. So they really do think that the United States is going to invade. They have thought for a long, long time, and it has been a justification for militarizing the society as much as it is militarized. Sometime back, I read a book on the Cuban military by a Canadian professor who said that per capita military, Cuba has a larger military than Canada, you know, which is amazing. So, you know, they're very militarized. And, you know, one of the unfortunate consequences of the embargo is that it has justified a lot of things, you know, and one of the things it has justified is the militarization of Cuban society.
Professor, historically, you know, when Cuba faces severe economic strain, migration increases. Mm-hmm. Are we likely to see another wave of Cubans leaving the island?
Well, migration has increased dramatically in the last couple of years. For fiscal year 23 and 24, together, it's 500,000 people who left the island for the United States. We don't even know how many people have left the island for other countries of Latin America. And since that time, also since this last, you know, two waves that were so the largest ever out of Cuban society, President Trump has made it more difficult for Cubans and everybody else, but also for Cubans to enter the United States without proper papers. So I think that the push for people to leave is there, but I think that at the present, they're going to have to go somewhere other than the United States because they will not be received in this country.
Professor Silvia Pedraza, thank you so much for your time this morning, your insight. It's something that we're certainly watching, and we'll talk again very soon.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah,
thanks.
Yeah, you got it.
I mean, it's a situation. I mean, 20 hours, 20 plus hours, no electricity a day. I mean, how can a society live? I mean, you know, not only you got schools and transportation and just families, you know. But you also have people, I'm sure, who have medical conditions who need maybe be hooked up to different machines and there's no electricity. What happens to them? You got people that are probably perishing over there as well.
Yeah, certainly. Meanwhile, interesting, plans for a data center in Washington Township have been withdrawn. This comes from a San Francisco-based real estate company that had put plans in for a 320-acre campus south of 32 Mile Road in Washington Township last year. The application's been withdrawn, but that doesn't mean that they're going to not resubmit
right
at some point. But it is an example that maybe some of the outrage over these data centers is making a dent.
Yes, and these communities, man, this local pushback is starting to really, you know, take shape and slow these expansions here.
Yeah. Meanwhile, in Lansing, there is a new legislation that's been introduced. It's an anti-fraud bounty plan to help investigate corruption here in the state of Michigan. We'll talk about that on the other side. It's JR Morning. It's WJR's Tim McGraw VIP experience. It's your chance to rock when country music legend Tim McGraw brings his Pawn Show guitar tour to Pine Knob Music Theater August 28th. What are you, boot scooting and boogieing
over
there?
Hey, man.
Yeah! You could win a pair of premium pavilion tickets, transportation courtesy of MetroCars, and $100 to Buddy's Pizza. To enter, download the free WJR mobile app, find the secret keyword, and then text it to 800-859-0957, 800-859-0WJR. For more information, you can visit WJR.com. Oh, my.
Yeah!
Lloyd's going to be front row at that show. Cowboy hat, big old belt buckle.
Well.
I should have recorded more of that so we can just keep playing until our guest calls in.
That's right. That's exactly
right.
Oh,
wow.
So State Representative Joe Aragona late last week, introduced a plan to help find and investigate corruption in state government. This particular plan would offer financial rewards to news reporters, members of the public, who find and expose waste, fraud, abuse, misappropriation, or other any misuse of taxpayer funds.
Okay. Well, you know, there are a lot of reporters who investigate, who do those types of stories. So basically he's saying, see something, say something. But when it comes to fraud.
Yeah.
And stuff that's not supposed to happen in the Capitol.
Yeah, he said government spending goes up every year, but local journalism is dying. That helps bad actors and makes it harder than ever to expose fraud. We need to change that. I want to shine more light on shady spending deals and expose as much wrongdoing as we can. This plan will help create new whistleblowers and bring new transparency to all of government. Mm. Well, here's what I would say. Unless you're like a... You know, if you are on the beat,
yeah,
right. That's what we call it in the business. Uh-huh. You're on the beat.
Yeah,
you could be on the Pistons beat. You could be on the Lions beat.
Mm-hmm.
You could be on the education beat. Mm-hmm. You could be in the Lansing beat.
That's right.
And those are your areas of focus.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, if you are a Lansing correspondent, you're probably not raiding burgers.
No. Right? Absolutely not. No.
You're not driving around to find the best Verner's on tap anywhere around the Metro Detroit area.
No, you're not doing
right?
that.
Right? So you have your focuses. Now, it is true. Certainly, journalism has been cut back a lot in the last handful of years.
Sure.
10 years or so now mm-hmm. at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But we've seen more of these like vigilante journalists that have come out.
Yes.
Online journalists, people on social media.
I see that. It's so many of them.
Yeah, too. That's kind of what happened out in Minnesota.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
That's how that got brought mm-hmm. about and brought to everybody's attention. So the idea of financially incentivizing people, and not even just journalists, anybody.
Just anybody.
Do you know what I love about it?
What's that?
I love that it might entice people to learn more about the system. It might entice people more to get involved. You know, you don't have to be a PI.
No.
To connect some dots. But it generally, I would imagine if people want to take this seriously and you want to
find out,
reap some sort of financial reward.
Yeah, I think it's a twofold. You reap a financial reward, but you also find out where your money's going, and if it's being, you know, spent or taken. I mean, when you start talking about the situation with $4,500 coffee makers.
Right, exactly.
I mean, you know.
$20 million to Faye Badoon. Well, yeah, how'd that happen?
Exactly.
Well, this is interesting, too, because those that would discover the abuse of taxpayer funds and report it to the state auditors general would be awarded 10 to 15% of the recovered funds.
Wow.
So that's not a small number.
So if it's a couple of mil.
Let me just tell you, people, Lloyd's face just lit up.
Let me make some phone calls here.
Whoa. Holy moly. Yeah.
You know?
So I don't know. It's an interesting plan. What I like, it's different. It's different.
It's out the box. It's definitely thinking out of the box.
It doesn't have to be, the same old song and dance. It can be a little different. It's thinking outside the box. So I'm on board with
it. I mean, we talk about transparency all the time. Sometimes, you know, this may help with that being some forced transparency once somebody finds out about something and puts it out there.
Yeah, certainly. You know, another interesting story is we keep hearing about the Michigan Democrat convention.
Yeah, yeah.
And everything that has surrounded that in terms of, you know, seem to indicate that there was some shenanigans going on.
Yeah.
You've got the Oakland County prosecutor, Karen McDonald, calling for an audit. Well, all of that controversy continues to grow. There's these disputes over these voting irregularities. And many of the state's high-profile Democrats, including Attorney General, candidates for Secretary of State, are all in the crosshairs here. So the real issue is whether or not the convention's electronic voting system worked properly. And because what we're hearing, and there's been new reporting out, I think, in the Detroit News, about whether or not votes were actually counted.
Yeah.
Like, I know how I voted, and I know how some other people voted, and the numbers, the math ain't mathing. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what's happening here? And again, there was real concern at the convention. Look, at these conventions, you're the delegates. You do whatever you want. You are the ones that are speaking on behalf of Democrats in the state of Michigan. And if you feel that this candidate is the candidate to go out and win a particular race, then
you
elevate them, right?
Right.
But if the votes aren't being tallied properly or the voting systems aren't being tallied properly, well, all of a sudden, are these the best, or should these be the candidates that are there, that have been elevated, that are now put in the spotlight, that are now receiving, you know, financial backing in their campaigns?
Yeah. So are people complaining?
Yes.
People are complaining about who is elevated and saying, hey, I don't know. I mean, how did that person get elevated? I thought it was more people.
Well, and again, you've
got
Karen McDonald saying, well, we need an audit.
Yeah.
We need a forensic audit to determine whether or not this was handled properly. Which sounds eerily familiar.
It sounds really familiar.
So I guess my point is, if you can't run your own convention properly, why do you expect people to then just blatantly believe all of the election confidence is there?
They're not.
I don't think
it's
so either.
It's not going to happen. No.
I don't think so either.
You can't. I mean, you blame them?
No.
Like that,
well, no.
Can't.
No. Of course not.
Yeah.
And again, the problem here is, There are, for as much trouble as Donald Trump has gotten himself into in the polling, he's you know, maybe broken apart to a certain degree some of the coalition that he built in 2024 to win the presidency. His approval ratings are way down. They've got everything going on in Iran, things like that. All of those things have hurt him. And as much as that should elate Democrats, they've got their own problems.
They got issues.
They got their own fire in a kitchen.
Yes, they do. They have their own issues. They got a lot to deal with.
So in a normal circumstances, Democrats would be licking their chops.
Oh,
and they
man.
Would be but
turning flips.
2024 certainly exposed a flaw. A flaw that I don't know that they've corrected. And now in a time when Donald Trump is weakened, I don't know if they
can't capitalize.
I think they will in the House.
In the House? Oh yeah.
But okay. Some of these state races, I don't know how that's going to play, because you're going to have somebody in some cases that is way more progressive than I think. We're in a purple state.
We are.
This isn't California.
We are. Listen, we could have.
It's not New York where they just elected a socialist.
Right.
This is not those places.
No.
So those races, the statewide races, I think the ones that are going to be impacted the most. Interesting. Coming up on the other side, there's a new president of the Health Alliance plan at Henry Ford Health. We'll talk to Margaret Anderson next on JR Morning. Well, Henry Ford Health announced that Margaret Anderson, the interim president of Health Alliance Plan HAP, will assume the permanent role of president effective immediately. And there has been a number of major advances under HAP. They surpassed goals for both member growth and financial stewardship in 2024, and they serve 476,000 members across the state of Michigan. And now the new president joins us this morning, Margaret Anderson. Good morning. It's so good to have you. Congratulations.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
So talk a little bit about what this means for you, what it means for HAP, what it means for Henry Ford, because there's been a lot of growth recently.
Yeah, so I'm excited to talk to you today. So I've been in this role now for about just under a year. And we really have been on a growth mode and a growth trajectory. And as part of our support of that growth in the Michigan market, we decided to go through a rebranding exercise most recently. And so we announced yesterday that we've changed our name, and we are now Health Alliance Plan by Henry Ford Health.
And when you stepped into the interim role about a year or so ago, what were some of the biggest immediate challenges you knew you had to tackle first?
Sure. Well, we had some issues relative to our government programs, products, just with all the changes that are happening from a compliance and regulatory standpoint. So we did have to address some of our pricing challenges and our product offerings. And then also just making sure that our brand was well recognized and that we were well known to people that were purchasing healthcare, so that we were in that consideration set when people were looking for options for their healthcare of choice.
Well, and healthcare is, there are so many different changes happening now, obviously. The technological advancements in the industry are certainly playing a role here. How are you overseeing all of that now, and what does it look like in the next 6 months, year, 18 months down the road?
Yes, I think it's evolving, I mean, literally by the day. And so we've actually been working very closely with Henry Ford as our enterprise strategy. And we take a look and say, how can we look at this from both the provider physician side and from the health plan side? And what are some of the things that we can do to improve consumer experience? So we're very thoughtful when we look at these opportunities and really want to look at the full continuum of the impact. But technology and artificial intelligence certainly is playing a role. Where we're seeing it showing up first, I would say, is in like our customer service centers, with the increase our ability to answer calls faster, to be quicker with responses, to help, you know, really leverage that technology to help our customer service agents. So that's where we're at today. But we're constantly evaluating and evolving our AI strategy.
And Madam President, HAP recently expanded, I understand, its network with 15 new hospitals, over 1,300 providers. What gaps were you trying to fill with that expansion?
So we moved, we've expanded up into the Upper Peninsula, just south of the Upper Peninsula, up into Traverse City and Petoskey area. So we have rounded out our network there. 96% of all providers in the Lower Peninsula are in the Health Alliance Plan network. So really important to note, while we are partnered with Henry Ford Health, we've been part of the Henry Ford Health family for 40 years, we do still accept and still do participate with 96% of the providers in Michigan.
You've been in different roles in places like California and New York. What separates Michigan from some of these other states where we've seen some bigger issues in the healthcare field? What makes Michigan different?
So I think it's interesting. I think you have to call out that you do have the dominance of one major health plan carrier here in Michigan. That's a unique situation as it relates to the Michigan market. Typically, you see market shares, you know, the most dominant player would have maybe 30 to 35% market share. Here in Michigan, we have a player that's at close, I think, to around 65%. So that certainly plays into the dynamics of the market. And I don't think you've seen as much of the national presence as some of the other markets have, such as like the Aetnas, the Uniteds, and Cignas of the world. So it's interesting because when we talk to consumers in Michigan, they really are excited and interested in talking to local regional people that know their market, know where they live, know what their unique needs are. And so that's a space that we're really stepping into.
And I know Henry Ford Health emphasizes equity and serving vulnerable populations as well. How does a health plan like HAP actively support that mission?
Yeah, we are very active in that space. In fact, yesterday we announced a community grant to four different organizations in Detroit as part of our Health Alliance plan by Henry Ford Health rebranding. We've donated $150,000 to really activate the brand and get people out there, have our employees out in the community. So one of the things I'm really excited about this year is all of our employees at Health Alliance plan have a goal of participating in two of our community outreach activities that we activate in the community. And so, people are really excited about it. They're really looking forward, to getting out there and really engaging with our consumers and our members across the many communities we serve.
Well, we are so excited that you get to scribble off the interim on your business card.
Right. Thank you.
It is the Health Alliance plan by Henry Ford Health, and it's Margaret Anderson as the new president. Thank you so much for your time. Congratulations again, and we'll talk very soon.
Thank you.
Yeah, you got it. Very cool.
Wow.
Meanwhile, Stellantis CEO Antonio Filiosa is set to unveil major new strategic plans this week as Stellantis tries to rebrand. Listen, they try to reshape. They try to refocus what they've been doing.
Everybody will have their eyes and ears open for that.
Yeah, and it's expecting something on the line of they have to fix the plan that they have going forward.
Mm-hmm.
They want to simplify the portfolio. They want to make sure that they are adapting to the changing industry, not chasing, a ghost through the EV space, right? While still being aggressive. You can't take your eye off that ball.
No.
But the demand just isn't quite there yet, and they're going to focus on a number of things like hybrids, things like that.
Yeah, you need to have some different products, some new products, and I'm sure the dealers are looking forward to that as well.
Yes. Particularly those Jeep dealers.
Yes.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. And maybe bringing some of those prices in line a little bit.
Yes, sir.
It'll be very interesting to hear what he has to say. All right, we're going to take a break. 8 o'clock hour coming up. We'll get you caught up on the headlines. Also, The Late Show is going off the air this week.
I know.
A changing landscape in late night television. We'll talk about it. Also, Donald Trump with an unlikely bedfellow for Trump RX. It's next. Just a little bit of a heads up. If it sounds like very shortly a very large, loud drilling sound.
There's a dentist inside here ready to give Chris a root canal, just so you know.
We've got some workers here just outside our studio window.
Uh-huh.
And if history has shown us anything over the last couple of days, it's been they've been drilling at different windows. Lloyd's going to go check it out. Are they still over there? All right. So we'll say, just so you know, heads up, everything's fine. But we're, just some maintenance that needs to take place here at the Fisher Building.
Sure. It's all fun except Lloyd leaning out the window yelling, jump, jump,
jump. Yeah.
I don't think that's cool.
Well, he's like, you guys good down there? You need anything? What can we get you?
Looks windy.
Yeah, exactly.
Nope.
Meanwhile, there were primaries all around the country yesterday. Donald Trump flexes those muscles.
Hey, man.
Again, it's primary time.
His numbers are low, but he still had a little pull in these primaries now.
Yes.
The general was a little different.
Totally different ball game. Totally different ball game. And we've seen a mixed bag of that in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But it is very clear that Donald Trump is the unquestionable leader of the Republican Party.
No doubt.
It is not up for debate. And there have been a number of upsets, including Bill Cassidy, incumbents who have lost their seats. Polling would show you that they were trailing or lagging behind.
Yeah.
But in Bill Cassidy's situation in Louisiana, that was Saturday. Then last night, Thomas Massie gets unseated.
Seven-term
congressman.
Yeah.
Gets unseated.
Yeah.
And he called to concede. He threw these Ed Gelrein. He was like, I took me a little longer to call the concession in because he's in Jerusalem or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're still
getting throwing punches,
a lot of that.
Yeah.
But Donald Trump flexing those muscles in the Republican primaries last night.
A Lincoln Park man is facing federal charges after authorities say he carried out a weeks-long cyber stalking campaign targeting former U.S. attorney in Michigan. Court records allege 51-year-old David Allen Morris sent hundreds of emails and voicemail messages over a 38-day period to former U.S. Attorney Matthew Snyder, who served as the region's top federal prosecutor from 2018 to 2021. Now, prosecutors say the messages escalated to threats of violence, including statements referencing Snyder's personal information and a claim about inscribing bullets with his name. Investigators say the FBI opened the case in early May after Snyder reported the harassment, and despite warnings to stop, the messages continued around the clock. Moore is now charged with cyber stalking and is being held without bond while undergoing a competency evaluation. He faces up to 5 years in prison if he's convicted.
Wow.
You know, that doesn't surprise me.
Matthew Snyder is a wonderful dude. Great
I mean, we
guy.
Have him here on.
Yes, frequently.
You know, as a guest. Great guy. I don't, you know, this guy, he's got to undergo a competency hearing. I mean, evaluation. I can understand that.
Well, I'm glad he'll be held to account.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We had some storms yesterday.
Did have storms.
And a couple of our metro parks are closed because of it. The Huron-Clinton Metro Park System says both Kensington Metro and Stony Creek were impacted by that extreme weather that moved through the area. Crews are on site assessing damage, cleaning debris, evaluating conditions throughout the parks. That's going to continue. A full assessment plan for later this morning. As now we have light up and they can kind of check things out. But you can guarantee that things will be up and running by this weekend because it's the big Memorial Day weekend. A lot of people at the parks.
Yeah, certainly. We've been talking a lot about the teen takeovers.
Yeah.
As well. Hold on. Let me turn my volume down on my computer. For some reason, that's up. It's like a faux pas on radio. but we've been talking a lot about these teen takeovers.
Yeah.
And there was a situation that erupted on a beach in Rhode Island. Three people stabbed at that beach as these teens packed the area.
Well, you know, as these teen takeovers continue, you know, at first they started out, you know, kids are together, you know, might be some horseplay, and then it got to fighting, and then we had a shooting here, and now it's a stabbing. I mean, it seems like it's getting out of hand. It has to be curtailed one way or another.
I guess my thought is, like, this is just me. This is the way I'm wired.
Okay.
Like, if I'm that age, and I was always this way, like, what are you doing going down there? And you know some stuff could get dusted up.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing going down there? Like, I wouldn't be doing that.
No. No, that would not be me. Would not be going that direction. Going the opposite. Absolutely.
I just don't understand. I understand you want to go out and have a good time, hang out with your friends, whatever.
Sure.
I would not be inserting myself in that situation.
I mean, you know, when I was a teenager, we didn't really hang downtown. It wasn't really anything downtown to hang about. We would go to the malls.
Right. Sure.
And we would hang out at the mall. Nobody started fighting and shooting people and doing at the mall. We just hung out at the mall, had a good time.
By the way, no arrests have been made in that stabbing. Three people sustained minor stab wounds. They were treated at the hospital. But no suspects have been identified. No arrests have been made in connection with those stabbings either.
Oh, well, there's more work to be done with these takeovers.
Yeah, you know, certainly.
And I think the city is trying to do something by giving the young people something to do and giving them places, you know, where they can hang and giving them different outlets. But you're going to have those kids who don't want to do any of those things and just want to cause trouble. That's where you bring in law enforcement to deal with that.
Yeah, and if you missed our conversation with Professor Kristen Nicole Henning at Georgetown, one of the things that she said, and you can hear that on WJR.com, one of the things that she said was, well, this idea of policing being involved here is too heavy-handed, that there needs to be different outlets for them, different services, different job recommendations, different mental health services that should be available to them, and that's how you break this. And it's like, well, that's fine.
And all of that is happening here. And I can't speak for other places.
Sure.
But all of that, what she said, is happening here. But you still got kids.
Right.
The ones who want to start things.
They're not interested in midnight basketball.
No.
They're not interested in going downtown, listening to a DJ and having a hot dog.
No. No, they're not.
They're interested in something completely different.
Yes.
Meanwhile, Trajan Langdon also spoke yesterday.
Everybody was waiting for that.
Postseason presser.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was enlightening because one of the things he said was, we didn't expect to be here at this point. Our guys have improved at such a dramatic rate that we didn't expect to be a 60-win team. Listen, we didn't expect to be the number one seed going into the playoffs.
They really did improve.
Yes, they did.
14 games. That
couple
they
years
won
ago, yes.
28 like losses in a row or something.
Right.
Crazy.
And so that was one of the things that they were talking about was this idea. Well, we weren't ready yet, and we weren't expecting to be at this point. But there was also a question asked, do you think that you should have made a bigger deal at the deadline?
At the deadline, yeah.
And he said, look, we turned over every stone. Some of the asking prices were just too high, and we weren't going to make those deals. And so we lived on the margins. Okay, fine. He also talked about Jalen Duren and his future.
It's pretty remarkable seeing you.
Wrong one. Try number two.
JD had a fantastic season. All-star, one of the biggest contributors to us being the number one seed. Darn near 20 points and 10 rebounds per game. An incredible year, an incredible leap from last year to this year because of the work that he put in last summer and his focus. And I have no doubt that we'll help him put a plan together, and he'll attack it this summer just like he did last summer. And he'll come back a better player from his experience, not only during the regular season, but also in the postseason, just like all of our guys will. So we look forward to coming together with his representation, getting a deal done, and for him continue to be a Piston.
Obviously struggled during the postseason.
He did.
No doubt about that.
But he really did well during the regular season, especially when Cade was gone. You know, he held on.
Well, now the expectations are there, though.
Yeah, and he has to produce.
All-star year, had a really great year.
Yep.
Now we need to see it again.
Exactly.
And we need to see the dominance in the postseason when we get back there.
Can you have your dentist use a smaller drill or something?
I need more of the silly gas. Let's go. Coming up on the other side, a lot of hate for AI these days. People are getting a little nervous. Why? And can we correct it? It's next on JR Morning. Look, you know I've been not a complete skeptic, but I have my concerns about artificial intelligence.
Okay.
You know, especially when it comes to jobs. Yeah. And I think you have to look at, okay, well, what happens if artificial intelligence decides to, or artificial intelligence will inevitably replace some workers, whatever number that is.
Sure.
Well, if you're that worker, that's going to be pretty impactful to you and your life and your family and what you're going to be able to do for work. So I think that is a healthy dose of skepticism. I also think that artificial intelligence is going to be really beneficial in a number of instances.
Especially like medical. We've heard about that.
Absolutely.
The medical field.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I think there are a lot of net positives, and I think there could end up being some net negatives, but we're not quite at that point yet. Right now, we're in the evaluation stage as a community.
Yeah.
Where are we at? What do we think? Well, one of the things, according to some polling, is that those numbers of people who are hating on AI or worried about AI are pretty darn high. And I love the first sentence in this Axios piece. If AI were a candidate for political office, it would be losing in a landslide. It was written by Madison Mills at Axios, who joins us this morning. Madison, it's great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So what polling are you referencing when you say that there is the AI's getting hated on at this point?
Yeah. Well, thanks for calling out the writing in an AI world. I really appreciate it.
I know that's right.
Listen, it's tough out here, but the polling, it's literally pick your poll, and you can see evidence of the AI hate wave that we're seeing right now. There was a YouGov poll that I found super interesting because it showed that no matter what political party you're in, the overwhelming majority of folks in it are not happy about AI. Then you've had other polls that compare how people feel about AI to other hot topics or current events, things like the Democratic Party, the war in Iran, ICE. AI is polling worse than all three of those things. So that just shows the degree to which people are not feeling great about AI. And it kind of makes sense. And you guys were talking about this, when the AI CEOs are telling everyone that this technology could take their jobs, it's not really a surprise that people aren't happy about it.
Madison, you know, even younger people who I would assume are most comfortable with technology are showing some, you know, low levels of optimism. Does that surprise you?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this idea of the AI haters that are also super users, and I would put some of the younger folks that I've spoken with in that category. You don't always love something that is shoved down your throat and forced on you, and young people are being told that they have to use AI, that they are the most susceptible to the AI hiring hit that we're seeing because entry-level work is getting crushed right now, and so they also are entering the workforce at a really unstable time, being forced to use this technology. In some cases, they don't want to. And so it's not super surprising to me, the hate that we're seeing from young people, but it does seem like it was surprising to a couple of commencement speakers over the last couple of weeks. So that was tough for them.
Are AI executives, are they embracing this, or is it something that they just can't believe?
Yeah, I've been asking AI executives for the last several months about this because we started to see this polling all the way back in February. So this is not new. It seems like at first the executives were, you know, very Silicon Valley response. They were very confused by this idea that anyone would be anything but thrilled about the presence of AI. But I think over the last couple of weeks, it's kind of hit a fever pitch to a degree, and there has been a little bit more comms massaging from the AI labs to try and get people to be a little bit more excited about it.
I know. Also, your reporting kind of notes that there's this growing resistance to data centers. Why are the communities pushing back on something most people don't really even directly interact with?
I think it's a lot of things. I think it's one massive physical eyesore that represents something that could take your job and impact your economic livelihood for the rest of your life. So I think in a way, it's kind of that like visual representation of the challenges of AI. But then there are also really tangible things. There's concerns about how it's going to impact electricity rates. In some cases, we're already seeing it driving people's bills up at a time when inflation is already a massive problem and so is affordability. So you don't want yet another thing adding to that problem as gas prices are also ticking up. You also have questions about whether or not this is the best use of community resources or if you want big tech companies kind of in your backyard. So a lot of those issues colliding at once, and then we're seeing this really playing out across local elections across the country and now even at the federal level with the Trump administration opening up to some AI criticism as well.
You know, one of the questions that I continue to have on this topic, and I really haven't gotten an answer yet because I don't know that we know the answer yet, which is AI at this point with a lot of these big AI companies, they are still in the fundraising stage. They are still being driven and held up primarily by investors who at some point are going to want a return on their investment. And at that point, is the technology going to be out of the realm of possibility for companies to be able to use that would replace those employees? Or are they going to lean into it, do away with the employees, and then hope in the long run it's going to be a net positive for them? We just don't know that yet, and that leads to the uncertainty.
Yeah, and that is literally the multi-million, potentially trillion-dollar question. I've been calling this AI washing when companies lay people off and say it's because they've adopted all this great AI technology. And then when I talk to those employees who got fired, when I look at those companies' earnings reports, there's not clear evidence that a lot of these companies have done amazing work on AI. It's just a convenient thing to say when you're laying people off, because right now investors love the story of AI efficiency, and that can be a story that boosts your stock price. Of course, there are real risks about AI replacing workers. I mentioned entry-level workers, for example, being hard hit. Some work like financial analysts, data analysts that you would just think with your common sense would be ripe for AI disruption are among the jobs that experts tell me are more at risk due to AI. But then, similar to every tech revolution we've had, they tend to create more jobs than delete them. And that's something that a lot of the economists I've talked to have said. The problem is going to be whether or not when companies adopt this AI technology and the AI companies inevitably raise prices because they've become public companies, will it make sense to continue to pay these high AI bills and lay people off when people might become cheaper than AI at some point? So that's going to be a very interesting question to watch.
Really interesting stuff. Great piece in Axios. Madison Mills, thank you for your time this morning. I hope we talk again soon.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, yeah, you got it.
I mean, you know, the future of AI, I mean, who knows? I mean, is it going to continue to be decided, you know, by engineers who build it or by the public deciding how much of it that they want in their lives?
I don't think the public gets a decision. I think at this point it is going to be so ingrained into what we do.
Kind of like the internet.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's exactly the same thing. It's just bigger. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Just bigger, more powerful, and gives you a much more narrow answer to your questions.
Yeah.
Coming up on the other side, what is going on with late night television as the late show goes away? We'll discuss. So tomorrow night, Stephen Colbert and the late show will have their last show.
Yes, sir.
And then it goes away. It's going to be replaced by, what is it, Comics Unleashed?
Comics Unleashed, yeah.
That's a Byron Allen production.
Absolutely.
And I think that airs at 12:35, which I didn't know.
No, I didn't know it either.
I had no idea.
But, I mean, you know, CBS, you know, paid a lot of money to produce The Late Show. It cost millions to produce, 200 people employed. But with Comics Unleashed, you know, Byron Allen is paying CBS.
Correct.
You know, leasing that time slot. So, you know, immediately profitable for the network.
A completely different set of circumstances for CBS.
Yes.
But Colbert draws roughly 2.5 million voters, or viewers, we'll call it.
Uh-huh.
And they get a lot of key demographics, 18 to 49, right?
Okay. Yeah.
But you look at other shows in late night. Jimmy Kimmel, 1.7. Jimmy Fallon, 1.2. Greg Gutfeld, I mean,
that's on Fox,
almost,
right?
Yeah, he gets almost 3.7 million viewers an episode. That's impressive.
Yeah.
Comedy Central, The Daily Show.
The Daily Show.
A million viewers. The realities are, I don't even mention Seth Meyers. He's under a million viewers. Whatever. The point is, the landscape is changing.
It is.
It used to be appointment viewing. People used to watch the late night shows because it was different. And now, I think to a certain extent, it's become a little stale.
It is stale because a host standing up, telling jokes, smiling, and sitting at a desk, and, you know, that's outdated, man.
It's like
digital age. Now.
I also
outdated.
I don't think they're really. I don't think they're especially funny. Like the stuff that they talk about is like, haha. Like it's not really thought provoking. It's generally pretty, you know, low hanging fruit.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just like, well, I wish I would have buttered my biscuit. It's like
you almost need a laugh track in the back.
What are we doing here? This isn't fun or funny. That's just me. That's my perspective.
Yeah.
And it feels like we are in a moment of change. And maybe the Tonight Show The Late Show is just the first domino to fall. Are you sad to see it go?
Not going to lose any sleep
over
it.
Does it bum you out?
I'm not going to.
Or do you care?
I wouldn't lose any sleep over any of them. I'm sleepy usually anyway. Yeah. I'm asleep before they come on, but I mean, I really wouldn't lose any sleep. Exactly.
Yeah.
No.
800-859-0957, 800-859-0WJR. It feels like the end of an era a little bit for The Late Show, obviously.
I remember Dad coming home, you know, watching Johnny Carson.
Right.
That was absolutely. That was must-see TV at the time.
Absolutely. No more.
No.
No mas.
No.
Brian, Jason, are you guys sad to see this thing go?
The show that I love, my favorite show of all time, was The Late Show with Craig Ferguson.
Really?
And that was 2014 that went off the air. And that was because, like, me and Brian were talking about it. He didn't care. Like, he did a 10-year deal, and he left. He didn't need a band. He had a robot.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I loved that show so much. And then he left. James Corden came in. He was pretty funny. And that's now what the Comics Unleashed now is in that time slot.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's like, you're right. The rest of these shows are so stale. And Kimmel is obsessed with Trump. We know that.
Right.
So that's an every night thing.
Yeah.
So you're dividing your audience there.
Yeah.
So
definitely.
Brian?
Well, they have changed. What Lloyd says is true. It's no longer relevant. It used to be fun. if you look at old clips of stuff, like when Carson was on, it wasn't him behind the desk promoting whatever movie this guy wanted to talk about. He would have four or five people, all from different celebrity, you know, there'd be a singer and a comedian, and
yeah,
and then they would all talk together.
And they would interact
they
with each other.
They all stayed there yeah. and had a conversation.
Yeah.
That was entertaining. This is it's just become a promotional tool.
It's a promotional tool for celebrities to come on.
Correct.
And they go, oh, I saw your Instagram account, and here. And they, you know, they hold the cue card up right. on the desk.
Yeah.
There. Oh, yeah. like this. And they go, oh, what were you doing petting that giraffe?
Yeah, like, I was going to say. A lot
I was
of
at the zoo. They were cute. How, it's like, what are we doing here?
How many right. times did you have you watched a late night show where a celebrity would come on and they would talk about nothing for 10 minutes, go to break, come back. Oh, and you're going to be in this movie, blah, 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 and then go to break again.
Yeah,
show
break.
A clip. Show a clip.
Let's see that clip. Yeah.
Yeah, right. But, the Daily Show is the funniest one. I mean, I know it's not a traditional late night show, but yeah. that show, well, I'll just watch clips on YouTube.
I think the
writers on that show are brilliant.
When Jon Stewart's on, it's a
Jon
very
Stewart
funny
is
show.
Hilarious. Yeah.
No, nobody else doesn't like Jon Stewart. No.
And then when you were saying the ratings have dropped off, they certainly have. But my question would be then, what about YouTube? Because I would imagine a lot of these things
20
are
million
being
subscribers
shunted over
I just saw for
well,
Kimmel.
Well, YouTube, that's the thing is if you look you know, at all of these shows or you look at. Even Saturday Night Live.
Yeah,
right.
They're putting full skits
correct.
On social media yeah.
mm-hmm.
because that's where people are seeing them. Nobody's yeah. watching Saturday Night Live.
No.
No.
I mean, I don't.
No.
You do. You're
I do
the,
watch,
I you're
I
the
do,
guy.
I
skip
do
through
watch
Sunday
YouTube.
Morning.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, on YouTube, I might record it and watch it yeah. later because it's late and I'm sleeping.
I think it's strange because it's different. Now these are going away. You're going to get new programming, things like that. But I think this is the first domino to fall. And I don't think anybody will particularly care.
Until somebody reinvents it. Somebody will come
well,
along like The Daily Show did, reinvent it.
I actually thought Conan reinvented it a little bit.
Yes.
And I liked Conan.
Craig Ferguson yeah. reinvented
Craig
it a little
yes.
bit.
But then even them, right? I mean, they're gone. I mean, so but, it's just, I don't know. Right. It's different because it's changing. But I'm not surprised it's changing.
But look at Gutfeld. He's beating all of these guys.
But
he's doing
but,
what they used to do. He's got a round table of different people yeah. talking.
And but you know what you're going to get with Gutfeld.
Yeah.
Right? You are going in to the political satire, the political
Colbert, too.
You know, he's heavily
exactly.
political.
Just different yeah. right-wing, left-wing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's it.
So you know what you're going to get. Right. Like, I don't, when I turn on Jimmy Kimmel, I know what he's going to say.
Right.
But that's not the format.
Yeah.
You're going to have Sydney Sweeney on to talk about her jeans campaign.
Right.
Like,
ooh, what time's that on?
Like, whatever. You know what I mean? So it's just different because it's changing. Also, I do want to bring this up. Donald Trump had the Mark Cuban at the Trump RX press conference yesterday.
Chris thought it was AI.
I thought, when I first saw it, I go, is that AI? That can't be Mark Cuban there. Here's Mark Cuban talking about the partnership.
Mr. President, I think other than you, I've been the biggest proponent of TrumpRx.com. And the reason for that is Republicans want cheaper drugs, independents want cheaper drugs, Democrats want cheaper drugs, and together, I think we're going to do something special. What makes Cost Plus Drugs different is that when you click through TrumpRx to our site, not only will you see a great price, but you'll see our actual cost and that we only mark it up 15%.
So there's Mark Cuban. Donald Trump was asked this question.
It's pretty remarkable seeing you and Mark Cuban up there and the fact that obviously Mark endorsed Kamala Harris back in 2021.
Well, he made a mistake. It was a big mistake.
But what does this say about what you two are building here? The
well, it says we love people. We love our country. He wants to, he's got a good company and he's going to do a lot of business with this. And I'm going to get drugs out through Amazon.
There you go. Donald Trump and Mark Cuban. Hell, Michigan is frozen over.
So when Cuban left there, did he go and fire Jason Kidd?
Well, he's not. I don't think he's one of the majority owners anymore.
He's not?
No.
I thought he was still in there. Where have I been?
No, he's
that
not.
That drilling, I don't know.
Funny story about Mark Cuban. I interviewed him during the campaign, and he told us that WJR was one of the very first buyers of his, like, streaming service way back
really?
In the day.
Oh,
he
wow.
goes, I owe a lot to WJR. Mark Cuban.
Wow.
Interesting tidbit connection to WJR.
Okay. All right.
All right, we're going to take a break. Coming up on the other side, it's Name That Tune.